Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, a podcast about the United States and the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm your host, Michael Patrick Cullinane. Okay, welcome back to the show. Today is slightly different because I am for the first time in the room with my guest, TJ Styles, and so it's a slightly different podcast than normal. I want to talk about biography today primarily because obviously TJ is a biographer. And there are many biographers that dip in and out of the Gilded Age, but not many that stick with it. I think a lot go back to earlier periods, Ron Chernow you can think of, or that move into later periods. But there's not many that I recall that make a career out of writing about this period's boldest personalities. And so I'm joined today by TJ Styles, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, National Book Award winner, and literary dynamo. Among his best-known work are three biographies of men who came to define the Gilded Age: Jesse James, the outlaw hero, hunted by the Pinkerton detectives; Cornelius Vanderbilt, the steamboat and railroad tycoon who became the world's richest man; and George Armstrong Custer, the cavalryman who defined the Indian Wars and his military prowess and failures. Today, we're going to be talking about the last one, Custer, but we may stray into some of the other books as we talk about writing, because all of these books will have interest to the listeners of this podcast. So let me just say one thing in advance of the show. This is, as I said, the first one that I'm recording live and in person. TJ is sitting alongside me in the office here at Dickinson State University in North Dakota. We're here for the Theodore Roosevelt Symposium. And so I'm just, normally I'm very reserved and I don't interrupt, but now you're here in person. I can interrupt, I can wave my hands. You can also see as I raise my eyebrow at some of the answers that you might give. So forgive me for any of that, and welcome to the show, TJ.
It's great to be here.
All right, well, I've been thinking, I guess, a lot about your literary accomplishments, which are pretty amazing. I mean, the Pulitzer Prizes, the National Book Awards and all that. But I've also been thinking a lot about how a lot of that has come as the biographies sit in this period. But you've talked, I read on your website, you've talked about how periodization is something that you want to blast through. So how do you do that in the books that you've written? They are of the period, but they're also beyond that too, right?
I think that's a good way of putting it. There's a tension between periodization and the problems of periodization and wanting to get rid of it. We need to be able to chop up time to talk about it, to understand it. And obviously, during certain periods, there are clear defining features. But when you look at human lives do not match the boundaries that we draw up when we study the past. They live across those boundaries. And that has consequences because somebody who goes into, say, the Gilded Age and who starts earlier, they carry forward the conceptions and the ideas, the goals that were formed in an earlier period. And so often the farther we go back, the more we understand, you know, what happens at a later date.
That's interesting because one of the things that I've been talking a lot on the podcast about over the last couple of years is that term itself, the Gilded Age, and interestingly enough, I think Mark Twain was referring to Shakespeare and gilding the lily. So there's even that long literary history there from, well, the 15th or 16th century to the 19th century.
And his concerns, there's the date of the novel, The Gilded Age, which is 1873, which is before when most people think we're talking about the Gilded Age. And what he was concerned with had nothing to do with income inequality and lavish lifestyles. It's a book about political corruption. And so it's strange how that has become attached to a later period where people are talking when studying it about very different issues. So Gilded Age is really problematic. And it makes, when you say Gilded Age, you're making a choice about what's important because, you know, gilded draws our minds to the wealthy and to their excesses, whereas a lot of other things are going on at the time. And it's, and I think the reason it's stuck is because it's so hard to come up with a catchy name that captures so many other things that's going on at the time.
I think that's true. And for as much as I agree with you about it, I dislike the term. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Doesn't give the full picture of any period. But then no term does. The one thing I do like about it is it does spark a conversation about periodization. Why do we have it? What does it do for us, if anything? I mean, in your mind, is there any benefit of classifying? Is there a taxonomy of times that's worthy at all?
Well, sure. I mean, why do we do it? Because it's helpful. Why do we use names for periods? It's helpful. There's a big debate about when Reconstruction really ended. Did Reconstruction end in 1877 when there was the notorious compromise that where federal troops were withdrawn from southern state capitals that still had black voters and black lawmakers? Or does it end far later? Because black politics continued after 1877, because black office holders continued after 1877. On the other hand, you know, that marked a definite period of change, and we can't just talk about everything as continuous. Then we're talking about nothing. So there's the tension. It's useful. We have to be able to break up the past to really zero in on certain issues, and yet we're constantly aware when you dig into the past how inadequate periodization is, but you can't get rid of it. So
there you are.
it's a real tension. I think it's healthy. I think in some ways that tension helps us not understand the past or recreate it, but you grapple with the various interpretations that we have of it. Maybe we can get into that too. Maybe dissect it through the life and times of George Armstrong Custer, who was, it seemed, fated to be a mediocre military figure, military officer. He finished bottom of his class at West Point. He was a Democrat when the Republican Party is on the rise. How does he stand out? And I know it's the Civil War, but how does he stand out in the Civil War?
Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to write about Custer is that he's like a tour guide to this period. You know, I mean, the period of the Civil War and its aftermath is really the big groundbreaking for what I would consider modern America. And he was in the middle of all of it. Restate your question again.
Well, no, I was just asking. It seemed like he was fated to be not even a footnote, and yet we've got all these books about him. How does he stand out and make himself into this, as you say, this sort of like guide for the Gilded Age, or not Gilded Age, but Reconstruction period?
I think one of the things is that he had... it's very hard to capture this in the documents, but he clearly had real personal charisma. And as he went through his career from West Point itself, where he really should have been kicked out according to the rules, through to all the big breaks he got, to his ability to survive some of his worst fiascos, he clearly had real connections with not only some of those under him, but also key figures above him. And he was constantly seeking patrons who really helped him along. The other thing is that, you know, his famous disaster that ended his life, as well as the fact that a lot of people just don't like him, can mask the fact that he had real ability, specifically in a kinetic military environment. And it became a pattern later in life where he would create career-ending problems for himself, and then he would have an opportunity to fight, and his capacity to fight well and meet expectations would save him from the troubles he'd made for himself. So his ability, he had native ability, but that native ability manifested itself in the less institutional environment. So he's going through West Point. He's in a very strict institutional environment, and he is more concerned with appealing to his fellow cadets. And in being popular, he's playing pranks, he's being boyish, he's being downright silly, breaking the rules all the time. But once he gets into the war, which is a far more chaotic environment, and he has an opportunity to operate many times with individual initiative, that suits his character and his abilities much better. And so, and that brings him to the attention of patrons who help him along, starting with General George B. McClellan. And it's fascinating because the two of them were socially complete opposites. Custer really is a product of border state culture. He's from, part of Ohio that's not far from the river. His father was from Maryland. There's a big swath of the border states north of the Ohio River that were really southern in culture. And he's clearly a product of that. And he was someone who was constantly creating trouble for himself. And yet, McClellan, who's from a very respectable family, who was at the top of the military hierarchy, socially as well as in rank, someone who'd been a president of a railroad during his time away from the army, he really takes to Custer and sees him as his chief protege. And Custer adores him, somebody whose military style is completely different than his, and yet he represents everything that Custer feels like is lacking in himself, that prestige, that sort of sense of institutional authority that McClellan has, and Custer so clearly lacks.
So let's talk about the patronage for a moment, because you mentioned McClellan and the difference between him, and there's also Sheridan later on, and there's senatorial patrons like Senator Christensen, right? But Custer cuts his ties with almost all of these people at some stage. McClellan, he kind of has to politically. Sheridan later on, in order to get ahead, in the ranks. How does that shape the story? Because it makes him to me seem even more unlikable in the sense that he's not really loyal even to those people that he is personally in his own mind affiliated with and likes.
Well, that is exactly it. I mean, on one hand, let's remember the sort of larger picture, which is the fact that the Army is kind of the pioneering modern institution. It requires merit. In the post-war Army especially, all the volunteer officers have to take tests to be able to stay in the Army if they want to become regular officers. It's a standardized professional organization. And before the Civil War especially, this doesn't completely go away, but before the Civil War, America is a very personal society, a very informal society. People get ahead in politics and in business through who you know. Patronage, which is, dispensing jobs to spread your influence and create a network of people who owe you, a network of followers. This is actually comes into the Army much more during the Civil War when you've got a mass organization of civilians who join the armed forces, the U.S. Volunteers, which is actually technically a separate army from the U.S. regular army. And so Custer is operating very much as an antebellum figure seeking out patrons. But in the Civil War Army, which mixes professionalism and, old style, who you know politics, it's a very smart strategy. And so Custer, so that's Custer reflecting the times and being himself. But he is ruthless. He wants to get ahead. And so, for example, when he was worried that he would not get his appointment as Brigadier General of U.S. Volunteers confirmed by Congress, he cultivated a local congressman from Michigan, which he'd adopted as his home state, a local congressman, Kellogg, who was notorious for wheeling and dealing and trading influence and favors, and really cultivated him. And then he wrote to a radical Republican senator. He was worried that he wouldn't get confirmed because of his Democratic politics, his Democratic background. And he wrote this insane letter, which he believed none of it, saying that he thought every man, woman, and child in the South should be hung and that it should be repopulated with loyal Northerners. And it was like he wrote a parody of what he thought radicals believed. It's absurd. And yet, you know, it succeeded to the extent where, you know, the questions about his loyalties and whether he was a copperhead or not faded, and he got his appointment confirmed. But it shows his ruthlessness. And when McClellan fell, he maintained a personal contact with him, but he didn't, you know, he denied. It was like before the cock crowed three times, he was denying McClellan. Not that I think he was a Jesus figure, but, and, you know, he was willing to do anything to get ahead. So he cultivated these sponsors, and yet, you know, he turned against them when he thought the time was right.
So he gets caught, though, a couple of times, and I love the play on words that your book is, because I open it up and I think, oh, these are going to be the trials of his life. But really, too, it's bookended by other trials, literal trials, court-martial. And so he has, he has three of them, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm. That's
and,
right.
And so how do those come to define his life as well?
Well, the first trial, which I opened the book with, was at West Point. He'd actually graduated, but they didn't have a post for him yet in the regular Army. And so he was technically still a cadet at the summer encampment where they trained cadets. And a couple of cadets got into a fight. And his job was, as captain of the guard, to arrest them both. And instead, he told everyone to stand back and let them have a fair fight. And that reflects the kind of romantic antebellum cultural side of Custer, as well as his own personality. And so they had court-martials for even minor offenses then. So he's court-martialed, convicted, but they're going to war. And he makes this kind of desperate plea, I know I messed up, but please, all my classmates are going to war, don't hold me back. So they let him go with just a slap in the wrist. But later, he's court-martialed after his first expedition in the West after the Civil War. And this is really important because he went West very much preoccupied with his own life. He would own life. He had been cheating on his wife, I believe, and he was constantly looking back to try to fix that. He was very concerned with politics. He'd gone on the famous swing around the circle that Andrew Johnson made to campaign against the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act and the radical Republican Reconstruction. And he was very vocal. Grant was disgusted with Johnson and left that tour. Custer was on the stand next to him. So he was under a lot of political condemnation from Republican newspapers that had loved him as a real combat officer, very successful combat officer in the Civil War. Now he showed his political colors, and a lot of the country was disgusted with him. So he was a man under pressure. And then he went on the Hancock expedition against the Cheyennes and other peoples of the Central Plains and got into a war that Hancock really provoked. And he spent his entire time in the field wanting to get back to his wife to fix the screw-up that he had made. And finally, he just abandons his men in the field. He takes a large escort, rides back to the post where his wife is, Fort Riley, I believe, and even abandons two men who got wounded in a skirmish, doesn't even try to find them and save them, but leaves them behind. Just complete dereliction of duty. He's arrested. He fights very hard. He's court-martialed. And yet he's let off with not quite a slap in the wrist. He's suspended from duty. And again, it's part of it is because of his holdover of his reputation as a great combat officer in the Civil War. And so, you know, Custer is, you know, he comes back from a year of suspension, and he's really at a crossroads. He could have left at that point the Army. He could have tried to make a go of it in some other field. And yet, the Army is the only thing he knows. And it's one of the ironies of his life. As America is becoming more institutional, Custer shows himself to be very poor at operating within that institutional environment where he's not the hero. You know, most of his time in the West is not time spent in combat. It's being an institutional officer, basically running a regiment during peacetime on what you might call constabulary duty in the West. And he's very bad at that. And he spends a lot of time away from his men. He doesn't manage his men well. And yet he never succeeds in making a life for himself outside of the Army. He only can continue forward within the institution he's so much at odds with. And it's to his great luck that the war that was started by Hancock sort of sputters on and then flares up again in 1868. And he's sent off on an expedition by General Sheridan to strike the Southern Cheyennes in the middle of winter when their horses are weak and when they're wintering along the rivers. And the army horses, which are these big bulky animals that can't survive on grazing, but the army has the capacity to bring the logistics with him. And so he fights the Battle of the Washita, which is very controversial. And yet he does basically what had been asked of him. And it definitely was a blow that had an effect in winding up that war eventually. So just in terms of what the military expected and wanted of him, he succeeded. And again, that's not an endorsement of the battle or the attack or the tactics and the results, but it saves him from the disaster he'd created for himself. And that is kind of a pattern in his post-Civil War career.
I hope everyone that's listening right now can get that sense of what a great biographer does. It's more than just the person. It's the context. And what you're talking about is not, it's the institutional revolution of America. Not the Industrial Revolution, the institutional revolution. And Custer fits as this turning point. And it makes so much sense when you say it, when you read the book. But it's important to reiterate that, I think, because that's what a great biography does. It gives us that sense of being in a place with this person and understanding it. So on that, with that idea in mind, let's go from 1874 to 1876 and talk about those last 2 years of his life and his time in South Dakota, the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and then, you know, how he moves north in those last 2 years. And not necessarily dwell on the battle, but how do we get from 1874 to that final battle?
Well, you're skipping over a lot of stuff.
Oh, there's a lot. And I've got more. I want to talk about the characters. We've got, you know,
I understand.
Important women to talk about. We have, First Nations people to talk about. We have so much more to talk about.
Chronology. And Custer goes on Reconstruction duty for 2 years, which is a period often overlooked and very important time when he was very much a part of Grant's offensive against the Ku Klux Klan, which he did not want to take part in. 1873, he and the entire 7th Cavalry, which had been split up around the South, are sent to South Dakota. And this is interesting for a lot of reasons that I go into, but let's just look at it in terms of his meeting the people of the High Plains who eventually kill him. In 1873, he goes on this large expedition, which is guarding the surveyors for the Northern Pacific Railroad. And again, this brings Custer into contact with a lot of the major themes of the period: the spread of the railroads and large corporations, the federal government's involvement in facilitating, partnering with the transcontinental railroads, and then their impact on Native people. So what's interesting to me, just in terms of how it relates to the end, is that during this expedition, he fights two battles with the Lakota and Cheyennes and some of their allies. And that's important because, you know, they're often dismissed as mere skirmishes. Whereas when you look at warfare in the West, most of the fighting between the U.S. Army and Native people in the High Plains or elsewhere is in much smaller numbers than what Custer actually engaged in. And in these two battles in 1873, on one, Custer was scouting ahead to find the day's campsite, so he had maybe 80 cavalrymen with him. And there's two interesting things about that. One is there was an attempt to lure him into a skirmish, as in the what's often called the Fetterman Massacre in 1866. Custer, interestingly, had read up on that battle and on the tactics. He'd been doing his homework, which we don't think of Custer. When it came to military operations, again, kinetic operations, he did his homework. And he recognized that he was being led into an ambush, and he pulled back. And then his men were surrounded by a large Lakota force, and he fought with real discretion. He didn't lead reckless charges. He pulled his men into a defensible perimeter, conserved ammunition. You know, he did very rational things, And he only, you know, led a charge once the rest of the force that he was with came up and basically relieved him. Then he was free to chase off the Lakotas, who were smart enough to pull back. The later battle, he was chasing after them, and again, he was hit by a very large counterattack. And he handled his men with real discretion. It wasn't the reckless fool that people imagined from the Little Bighorn. He really kept his men in hand, really conserved his resources. So what does that tell us? It tells us that he had two major tactical engagements in which he showed an ability to really read the enemy, read the situation, in which he wasn't reckless and headstrong, but you know he was very careful, and he was aggressive at a time when it was basically safe to be aggressive when he got reinforcements. And that's very interesting because it puts a different light on the way he died. And I don't pretend to be an expert on the Battle of the Little Bighorn. You know, I showed my chapters to the late Robert Utley, who had, you know, was noted historian for a couple of generations of the Northern Plains and the West. And he said, I'm glad you didn't really go into detail on the Little Bighorn because everybody, including me, would have disagreed with something you said. So it's highly disputed. And yet, you know, Custer is not a fool and he's not incapable of fighting against Native people. And which is very important for understanding the Little Bighorn, because if you think of him as a fool who just throws away his men, it really doesn't make the victory over him a very big deal. And in fact, just to give away my own conclusion, I think I agree that with other historians have said, you know, we should look a little less at Custer and more at Indian leadership and fighting capacity, because they really won that battle. Now, in terms of how he got there, you know, Custer had embroiled himself yet again in the politics of Reconstruction. And he had was very excited by the takeover in the 1874 election by Democrats of the House of Representatives. And it's very much like recent politics where one house gets taken over by the opposition party, they launch a series of investigations, and Custer, as a serving career Army officer, went to Capitol Hill. He was called to testify, and he not only testified, often very loosely, about things he didn't really know about personally, but he socialized and appeared in public with the Democratic leadership, the political opposition to his commander-in-chief. He wrote notes on their stationery in the House chamber. He had lunch with them and walked around Capitol Hill with the Democratic leadership, and he really angered General Grant. And I think General Grant really had a right, President Grant, excuse me, he really had a right to be angry with Custer. And so when the, so that's one side. So, you know, he was assigned to the expedition to go to the Little Bighorn, and he was pulled off it by Grant because he was so furious with Custer. And it was only when Custer had to break down and beg in terms that were very much like his appeal to his, his defense in his very first court-martial, where he says, my men are going off to fight, and you're going to leave me behind without them. And so finally, Grant relents and allows Custer to go off to his death. It's just fascinating. The other aspect of course, is the story of the Black Hills and Custer's leadership of an expedition to the Black Hills. Now, often, you know, this is depicted as an expedition to provide a pretext for taking away the Black Hills. In fact, I think when you look at what Sheridan was concerned about and the Army's concerns at this time, there were a lot of conflicts going on or pending in the West, and the Army was the regular Army is very small. And so the what they called the Great Sioux Reservation, plus unceded lands that were recognized as theirs, was a huge area. The Lakota Nation was one of the largest and most militarily powerful. And so Sheridan's strategy was to kind of ring Lakota territory with forts so that he could launch retaliatory raids and kind of keep them conflicts with them under control with a minimal force. So he had a force available to locate to other hotspots in the West. And the big hole in his perimeter of forts was the Black Hills, that corner of the Great Sioux Reservation. So he wanted to build a fort there, and he sent Custer to reconnoiter. So Custer, not only did his men and the geologists with his expedition find gold, But Custer publicized the fact that gold could be found in paying quantities by someone with no expertise and basically just a pan. And that's important because all the great gold rushes started with this democratic phase, as Patty Limerick has written, where people rush there because gold can be found with basically no capital investment, California and everywhere else where there were gold rushes. And that's very much true in the Black Hills, and Custer himself is responsible for that. So he didn't go to find gold, but he very much publicized the gold that was found, and that led to this inrush of migrants that induced the Grant administration, which was very much pro-development. I mean, the mining law that allowed people to just start tapping Western resources with no payment to the government was passed during the Grant administration. He was very much pro-Western development. And his vision for the natives was assimilation, not recognition of their sovereignty, which, as I mentioned, had been taken away. So that really sets in motion the kind of deliberately provoked conflict that leads to the 1876 war and Custer's death.
Okay, now I promised I'd go back because there's a lot that we've skipped. And I want to talk about the women in his life. And there's two women in particular that are really important that you write about. Obviously, one is his wife, Libby Custer. She so reminds me of Eliza Schuyler. You know, a woman who outlives her husband by 55, 56 years, mm-hmm. just like Eliza Schuyler, also creates a legacy for him. And same thing with Eliza Brown, same first name, right? Mm-hmm. Who is kind of his aide-de-camp for a long time. And they just seem to be such rich and vibrant characters in a story. I almost want biographies of them to be written because they seem to be as exciting as Custer himself.
Yeah, this is interesting because, you know, this goes to part of what the art of biography, which is, you know, when you want to explore larger subjects, you've really got to find an organic way of bringing them in and making them a part of the story. And also thinking about characters who get overlooked and yet have a major role in your main character's life is important. And one of the things I was excited about in writing about Custer, who was such a famously macho figure, he was constantly at war, dies in battle, is that the women in his life were strong, intelligent, major characters who also had conflicts and friendships with each other. So it's not just about them and Custer, it's about how they related to each other. And, you know, he met both of them during the Civil War. He met Eliza Brown, who was a self-emancipated woman. She was a black woman who was still a teenager when he met her. She had escaped from the farm in Piedmont, Virginia, where she had been held. And after the Gettysburg campaign, when his brigade came down into that part of Virginia, Custer decided he was a newly made general. He wanted a cook, personal cook. So he goes to the contraband camp, and she kind of talks back to him, Eliza Brown, and he really impresses her with her intelligence. She goes to his command post in his brigade camp, and here she is. She's a black teenager in this white male military environment. And she succeeds through strength of will and through a real kind of cunning understanding of how she can exploit her position to create actually a certain amount of authority for herself. So, you know, the men come to her to intervene with Custer when they need a favor or a request. She becomes a banker. She takes the men's money when they go into battle. She pumps visitors to the post for information. She becomes an information broker. She's just really fascinating. She's not just a cook. And she's running his household when he shows up with his wife. He got married in the winter of 1864. And, you know, he comes with her. And she is a white woman from a middle-class background where the only authority she expects is to run the household. But if she were to take over the authority from Eliza Brown, Eliza Brown would feel threatened. So Eliza Brown, it's a fascinating relationship where there are two women in this all-male military environment, which continues for years. So they're allies, they're friends, and yet they're constantly subtly struggling for power. Where Eliza Brown is she's very comforting and she's very, you know, sort of soothing, and yet she uses that to kind of put Libby cuts her on a back foot, and she doesn't know how to get around that. And their relationship starts to have more and more conflict, where Libby, even I think in her own autobiographies or her own memoirs of her time with Custer, sort of takes posthumous revenge on Libby, kind of ridicules her. And finally, in 1869, after the conclusion of the Central Plains War that included the Ouachita, she is infuriated with Libby Brown over this whole issue and fires her. And, in the meantime, that whole story is just really illustrates, black-white relations, especially in the Army. It illustrates women and their relationships with each other. And at the time, their opportunities for authority and it's just a plain fascinating personal relationship as well. They're both fascinating women. And they come back at the end of the story, where in the epilogue, Libby has written her first volume of her memoirs. She manages to track down Eliza Brown and sends her a copy, and then they get together. And Eliza Brown, the second book in her trilogy, really shows the memories of Eliza Brown, because she's a much more vivid figure. There's much more interesting detail on camp life and on what was going on. And she really is the one of the great characters of Eliza Brown or Libby Custer's writing. And so they get together and they meet in New York, and it's just a really fascinating reunion, in the years after Custer has died.
And there's a photograph, right? Is there a photograph?
Yeah, well, there's a few photographs of them together. One is when he was in Reconstruction duty in Texas. But there's another that shows during the Civil War, and it famously shows them in, like, physically, in terms of height, in the hierarchy of the time. So Custer is the tallest one. He's standing up. Then there's Libby sitting down. And then sort of sitting on the floor is Eliza Brown. And it's fascinating because that shows the official hierarchy, and yet Eliza Brown really is an independent operator. And there's times, even like in the West, in Fort Riley, when the 7th Cavalry marches off to fight in the Hancock Expedition, and a black regiment moves in. And Libby Custer is terrified. She's got all these racist ideas that the men are all rapists. And Eliza Brown is kind of disgusted with her. And so Libby Custer feels like she's being protected by Eliza Brown, who thinks it's preposterous. I mean, it's really fascinating stuff.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Another person that really captivated me in the book was Custer's brother, Thomas Custer. So I knew nothing about him really before reading your book. And then the part that really got me is that one of the court martials, Thomas Custer, testifies against his brother.
Yeah.
And basically does him in. So yeah. How does that relationship work? How does Thomas survive in the army for so long in the same regiment as his brother?
Yeah, this is, again, you know, fascinating overlap of, you know, an older era of patronage and of nepotism and, you know, the supposedly modern, you know, professional army that has, you know, 400 standardized forms and, you know, has procedures for everything, where Custer manages to get Tom assigned to his brigade and in the Civil War, and who he manages to bring on to into the 7th Cavalry when it's formed after the Civil War. And, you know, Tom is, a lot of people like him more than Custer because they're similar in the best ways, where Tom is a, you know, he's a real warrior's warrior. He won not one but two Medals of Honor in the final campaigns of the Civil War. And, you know, he's very much a highly capable soldier. He's also loves pranks and, you know, he's kind of a, you know, kind of a boyish figure like his brother, but he doesn't seem to have had as many of the self-serving traits that made his brother unpopular.
He's honest, right? I mean, there's an honesty about him as well that's admirable.
Yeah, there is. And so, you know, when Custer abandons his men in the field and, you know, there's a point where a couple of men, you know, deserted. Desertion rates were unbelievable after the Civil War. You know, and they, you know, Custer orders them to be shot down. And there's a moment, I have to say, I'm blanking what the exact question was, but it was totally damning of his brother Custer, or brother George Armstrong Custer, you know, where he's basically put on the spot and he has to say, you know, no, he didn't, or, you know, yes, it was him who ordered this.
Did he abandon his post, right? Which
yes.
Kind of the question.
Exactly.
And he says yes, and that's like the nail in the coffin, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was really kind of devastating. And yet, you know, they were very close. I mean, the Custer family was extremely close. And, you know, he brought his, you know, his younger brother and his nephew, along with, of course, Tom on the Little Bighorn expedition, and they are all killed. So so that close family ties, which he had, you know, which is actually one of the best things about him, you know, really loved his family, truly did. And there are wonderful letters between him and his sister and other relatives during the Civil War, like when his niece wrote and said she wanted to send him a bowl of gravy, you know, in the army, thought he'd like that. You know, it's a lot of really touching stuff, but in the end, you know, he managed to get a lot of his family killed.
Yeah. Something about the biographies that you write, and I want to ask you, I suppose, about conceptualizing a book. Because I think people listening would be interested to hear about how the idea springs to your mind. You talked a little bit about why you picked Custer. What about men of action? A lot of your books, I mean, there's Cornelius Vanderbilt, definitely a man of action. Custer, Jesse James, Theodore Roosevelt. These are characters that they're very masculine, too. I mean, I think your stories tell about a lot of different voices in the book. But how do you pick a character?
Well, you know, I have to say, I like a good yarn, you know, and, you know, I like an adventure story. And Ron Chernow did a great job with John D. Rockefeller, but I, you know, I don't think I could have written that book. Nothing against piety, but he was a pious bookkeeper. And as much as a lot of his business operations are ruthless, you know, Cornelius Vanderbilt was somebody who was engaging in steamboat races, survived steamboat explosions, got into fistfights, waged a private war in Nicaragua, you know, erected a single-handed blockade of the city of New York at one point. I mean, that's a business life that was a lot of fun to write. Doesn't mean that I approve of everything he did. In fact, you know, Theodore Roosevelt is the first subject I've had that I really personally like.
I was going to ask about that, too. Some of these people are really uncomfortable.
I know.
How do you deal with that? Because you've got to live with
these
characters for a long time. I mean, years, decades even, you know?
The biographer Brenda Maddox, who's a British biographer, is very interesting, said she was asked this, and she said she once wrote an essay on the topic called What's Love Got to Do with It? And, you know, if they're interesting and they're important, And better yet, if they're contradictory. So you have to understand different sides of them that were maybe never even reconciled in their own lives. That's the best. That's the sweet spot. So, you take someone like Custer, and like I said, I started off with the idea that he's like a tour guide to all these changes happening in America. He shows in his own life how what happened in the West was tied to the East. What happens in the South is tied to the North and West. That there are all these big changes in America that are tied together, and he illustrates and takes you there. And yet, as I worked on the book, I developed this idea that what we're seeing in all these different areas of his life is kind of the birth pangs of modern America and the idea of universal individual rights, and then how that relates to native sovereignty and the survival of native people as peoples. The rise of the stock market, of the kind of formal financial economy. Custer went off. He spent a total of about 2 years in New York trying to make a go of it on Wall Street after the Civil War. Ends up leaving his terrible at it, left his wife a huge debt, which he didn't know about till when he died. But, he's a guy who's tied into all these things. He's on Reconstruction duty in the South. He's, in New York, taking part in the cultural life as well as the financial life in New York. He's out West. You know, I find it interesting that in his book, My Life in the Plains, when he describes the march to the Ouachita through a blizzard, he says, you couldn't see more than twice the width of Broadway. Well, he didn't bother to explain. He meant Broadway in New York. And he's self-consciously, identifying himself, almost putting himself at a landmark in the most metropolitan part of the U.S. And that shows how when he's in the West, he's thinking about the East. You know, when he's in the East, he's identifying himself with the West because that helps him, personally and gives him notoriety in a good way. So his inability to reconcile with all these changes is the secret to a lot of his own conflict and his failure and makes him interesting even when he's at his worst. Why is he at his worst? Not just because he's a bad guy, but because he's having trouble adapting to the way the world's changing. Why is the world changing? Well, he's playing a part in that. So the very world he's helping to make, he can't learn to live in. So that makes a good story. You don't have to like him all the time. You do have to understand why other people liked him. And a lot of that has to do with characteristics that people don't like to give to him, because we like to think that somebody we don't like is a coward. We attribute or is a bad fighter. And we like to attribute moral qualities to military qualities. In fact, a lot of the best fighters and commanders in history have been real jerks. And Custer could be a real jerk. I mean, his men in the Civil War loved him, but that was a national war dedicated to a clear national cause in which he was in constant combat. And he was a good fighter. He was personally a good fighter. And if you want to just condemn him, for A through B because you dislike him legitimately for C through Z, well, you're not getting the truth, And same thing with Vanderbilt. He was ruthless, and yet he did have his own personal code. He wasn't just ripping off the companies he ran. He was totally ruthless about crushing out the competitors and raising questions about private power in a democracy. Those are real serious questions we still struggle with. But he personally wasn't just a crook. And so I had to say, I developed a lot of respect for him, even though he was a jerk to his wife and kids, for example, even though he also struggled with that. And finding the contradictions and the way in which he was a real human being made the less tolerable stuff livable. Like, we can see him now. We understand where he's coming from. He's actually struggling with these things, even though sometimes he comes down on a side we don't like. It was less easy with my first subject, Jesse James, because there was so little about him. We really look at him from the outside. So there's glimpses of his sense of humor, of, the fact that he too was a good fighter and he was quite daring and a lot of people loved him. And yet, he was a truly ruthless figure who fought for slavery and for the overthrow of Reconstruction. And that's why he became famous. He wasn't giving money from the rich and giving it to the poor. And when you mainly see the public side of him, how he appealed to the press, how he carried out robberies and killings, it's hard to humanize. I did my best, but it's much harder to humanize him than with the later figures.
So you're graduating. You're moving from less savory characters to more savory. But I mean, they all, as you say, they all connect our history, I suppose, national, global history of the United States. I want to ask you a little bit about writing as well, because there's a great podcast out there called Writing the Past. I don't know if you've come across it, but
I actually haven't listened to it, but I've heard of it.
Yeah. They just ask writers about method. And one of our first exchanges was about a word and word choices and vocabulary. Yes. It was over email, but yeah. It made me think about you being very passionate about language, which really shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone because you're a writer and that's your trade. But I wonder what you thought about our language and our times. And what I mean by that is, are we suffering an understanding of the power of language and its uses now? There is some, you know, talk about that. There was an article in the New York Times just this weekend about our culture is less robust and exciting than it has been in the last 500 years. Do you think that in some ways we are, whether it's text messages or sound bites, that we're not developing our culture enough, our writing, our literary sort of, I don't know, the culture, the literary culture of now?
So that's an interesting question. You know, it reminds me of something that an old saying in publishing, which is in book publishing, which is we're always living in the worst time ever in publishing. So there's always kind of a doom saying that goes with things like language and culture. And people have been complaining about the decline of the English language probably since Chaucer. I would say that, sure, there's some of that. Our exchange actually was about the word disinterested, which is a word that's very important to me because it doesn't actually mean uninterested. It means you lack an interest in the topic at hand. Not you're impartial, but that you lack a stake. A disinterested judge does not own any stock in the company that, you know, there's a trial over its contracts. An impartial judge may own stock, but can still treat the company fairly. So that's a fine line of distinction in one word. So when we lose that, and it just becomes another word for uninterested, we're losing a shade of meaning and an economy of language that I regret. And yet, language is always changing. I mean, there are a lot of French words that came into the English language twice, you know, like hostel and hotel. Mm. And we have shades of meaning that result. And then we drop some words, like hostel isn't used very much anymore except for youth hostel. And so then that the shades of meaning in that is now gone. We live, we go on. And we're developing new modes of language. What I think is important is always using language deliberately, as Orwell wrote, not letting your phrases and your cliches write for you. You know, it's not like putting together a Lego set where you just click together blocks of words. You have to really think about every word and make every expression fresh if you can. I fail in that. A lot of people do. But there's a lot of great writing going on. I mean, I think of the first novel I was ever asked to review was Tommy Orange's There, There, which was a novel about Native people living in urban areas, you know, whereas usually we think of reservations. In fact, most Natives in America today live in urban areas. It's what he calls a polyphonic novel, where it's written from different perspectives, but also in different language. You know, I mean, first person, third person, second person, and it's brilliant. And it uses language in each chapter in different ways. And it just is a real illustration of the kind of inventiveness and precision and evocativeness of language, which is fresh and new and we haven't seen before. And that's happening, you know, all the time. And as book publishing and authorship is becoming open to more and more people, you know, we're seeing more and more of that. It's a really interesting time, and it probably has always been a really interesting time.
Well, that's the reason why I ask you, actually, is because in your books, you use a lot of literary references of the time that you're writing about. So not literary references from today, but literary references from Reconstruction era. And they're not necessarily American sources. They could be, you know, literature from other parts of the world. But you use that often as a hook. So I was wondering about how that was. Was that a component part of your writing style? Do you think a lot about the literature of those times? Tolstoy, for example, you write about in Custer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that having a, you know, reading fiction, reading literature, and thinking about, I mean, this is how we get knowledge about life, about the human condition. And the best nonfiction, like the best fiction, can be about the human condition. You're writing a biography, you're writing about what it's like to be a human being moving through the world. And so I like to say biography exists in this crossing ground between literature and scholarship. So it has to be documented, it has to be sourced, and preferably it creates an addition to our knowledge. It's expanding our knowledge about history, about other aspects of the world. But you are delivering a life story, and that is a contract with the reader. They expect to get a beginning, a middle, and an end. They expect to know what this person did, what their life was like, and to follow that life story. If I am true to that contract, then I can use that to expand the story to a larger questions. But I'm also under the I'm also facing the requirement that those larger questions always have to be pertinent to and enhance our understanding of the biographical subject. So I have to say, you know, I'm not above cheap tricks. Rather than start off the chapter when Custer goes west with a long, a monograph inside the book about High Plains Native peoples, I wait until Custer goes out on the Hancock expedition. The cavalry rides over a crest of a low ridge and sees a line of Native warriors all in battle regalia, ready to fight, and everybody's expecting a battle. Then there's a break, and I say, okay, who were they, and why are they lined up there? Because the writer David Lodge said, fiction is all about, and I think nonfiction can be too, narrative nonfiction should be too, raising questions in the mind of the reader and delaying the answers. Well, in this case, I use that delay to inform the reader, to fill in the faces, the people on the other side. You know, it doesn't pretend to be a history of Native people, and I don't want to pretend I do, but to give some background understanding of how they got there, how the conflict reached this point. And then I come back to Custer, and then now we not only understand more of why they're facing each other, but what the stakes are. The stakes are for people on both sides. And that's the thing, is that, you know, creating expectations and then in some way fulfilling them is your job as a writer. As a historian.
You make it sound all very easy.
Yeah, no, it's
I imagine that there's days when you're at your office or wherever you write where it's not that easy. It's you know what you're going to do, but getting there is a challenge.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's tough, especially with someone like T.R., who not only had, you know, this very big productive life, but he was big and productive in so many different roles. So, you know, this chapter is about his being Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Well, then you've got to go into the history of the Navy and of institutional reform in the Navy and changing technology and other powers and the threats they face. You know, like it's, you know, and then you've got to still be telling this narrative story where he's going somewhere with this. And, you know, then before that, there's his civil service commissionership, which sounds like such a boring topic, and yet in some ways is at the very heart of what my book is about. You know, it's about a reinvention of democracy. It's about a total change in American politics and why people voted and why people were involved in politics. And in this seemingly boring, you know, it's like he's an HR officer. That's what you think.
It is. And coincidentally, it's his longest job outside of the presidency.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And he never stops caring about it, and it never stops being at the core of what he's doing, including about his ideas and his policies regarding natives, you know, which is something when I give a talk for the symposium tonight, I'm going to be talking about. And so how do you know, like we're leaping from major topic to major topic, and I'm constantly struggling with keeping it contained so you're not feeling like somehow I've ended up in a different book, and feeling why it matters, and making sure that it's about TR at the same time, so you're understanding him, and this is the story you signed up for, and yet feel also then the result, oh, this really matters, I'm really learning something, the aha moment of nonfiction. And they, you know, that's a constant struggle. When I wrote about Vanderbilt, you know, one of the most fascinating areas of his life is when he started this transcontinental steamship line during the California Gold Rush. And most people and all the commerce did not go by overland wagon train. It went by steamship through Central America and before the canal. It's why we wanted to build a canal, that kind of stuff. So he actually, he ran his land transit across Nicaragua, and he got deeply involved in a civil war in Nicaragua when an American soldier fortune took over the country. And Vanderbilt helped kick him out. Custer would have been on the soldier of fortune side without question. And it's a fascinating story. And my editor sent back the early chapters before I revised them with just one line: you must cut out vast swaths of material about Nicaragua. And I basically had to cut out a book within a book. It's what a friend of mine calls research euphoria, where you get so carried away, feeling like nobody's ever seen this before, and you write way too much, and you get away from your real story. So, you know, it's part of the struggle of writing narrative nonfiction.
It is. Now, we're also joined in the room today by another friend, Clay Jenkinson, a scholar and a podcaster himself. Clay's got a podcast called Listening to America, and I thought I would give Clay an opportunity to ask the last question today.
Whoa. Or criticize, too. Take me down a peg.
I've been listening with great joy. So, you know, we're in North Dakota. He was stationed here, kind of chafing at the bit, goes down to on the Thieves Road to South Dakota.
We're not talking about Roosevelt now, we're talking about Custer.
We can talk about Roosevelt. No. But Custer, so.
Yes.
And what strikes me is that he had one of his scouts do a forced march to get to Laramie, to get the word out immediately that
yes.
he had found gold. He expected to find gold, took prospectors and newspapermen, found gold, and then immediately publicized it to the country.
Mm-hmm.
This was 1874, the year after the big economic collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So what's his strategy here? I mean, he's not saying, let's open up the Black Hills up and just take them from the natives. There's way more going on, right?
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, we have to remember that there was a long, going back many years before this expedition, expectation that there was gold in the Black Hills. And that, you know, there's newspapers, some of which I cite, newspaper articles, from years before talking about, you know, a group of prospectors was driven out by the Lakotas or the Sioux, they would have said, and, you know, and killed or driven off, that there were multiple expeditions, civilian expeditions, to find gold there. So Custer brought geologists, but frankly, anyone would have, you know, any Army officer. Other expeditions often had geologists along. And you know, the thing is that Custer was very much on this expedition for a military, you know, for a find a tactical site for to implement a military strategy of containment. And yet he knew that he wanted attention. He wanted to make a splash. He wanted to make an impact. You know, he was always worried about his position. One of the things I mentioned in the book is that when he was relocated to South Dakota, and then he had to move his men to the launch point for the Northern Pacific Expedition, he complained that he didn't have enough wagons to move everything. And so he's corresponding with the department headquarters. And General Terry was away, so his senior officer on the spot was communicating with him about what Custer was saying. And it was just total derision. I mean, he had such a bad reputation in the Army, as somebody who couldn't get along with the chain of command, that that this affected the way the Army, you know, even dealt with him on a subject of how many wagons does he need. And so he gets 1874. Again, he's still under tension, and he knows it. And I think, this is my personal judgment as a biographer, that affected a lot of the things he did, along with his desire for notoriety and fame, which is always there. And so when you know, he finds gold, you know, he again sends off a scout with this news because I think, you know, he thinks it's big news, and I think it's going to draw attention, and it's in the middle of the depression, not a recession, but a depression, and he's going to get a lot of fame for it.
He's going to be the hero of the story, right? If
Exactly.
But he's not a fool. He knows that this is going to touch off a lot of chaos in Western South Dakota.
He has to. And, but, you know, again, putting him in context, you know, he was, it's a very interesting kind of attitude where if there's natural resources in the West, it doesn't matter who has the rights to them, we should develop them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that General Grant had signed the mining law of, what was it,
1872.
Thank you. And was, you know, very pro-development. You know, we talked about this before. I won't go into details now. But I like to think of the conflict as one of world systems, to borrow a term that's used in a different way by Emanuel Wallerstein. You know, just like you've got multiple diverse nations and societies, but they recognize each other and they operate, they work with each other, go to war with each other. They recognize each other. The Europeans get to North America and they see their people here, but they don't recognize the world system that exists. And this world system is still existing and operating in the Northern Plains, where the Lakotas have alliances with the Cheyennes and Arapahoes and others. They're waging war over natural resources, over the best buffalo sites and other natural resources, winter watering places, etc. They're engaged in long-range trade, trade that with, you know, the Americans in the European world system and with their native friends and allies. So the native world system from, you know, 1600 is still in a, you know, confined form, still existing here. And the European world system, in this case represented by the U.S., you know, it just doesn't recognize it and certainly doesn't see it as legitimate. Ultimately, it's got to give way. So they deal with it when they have to. They don't have the troops to just go and conquer the Northern Plains, and there isn't enough reason to yet. But once they get a reason, they're going to go and do it. And Grant, you know, who's, you know, famously has a peace policy, he endorses basically a provocation to war in order to create an excuse to take over the Black Hills.
Let's get it over with. So you're talking a lot sort of out of Pekka Hämäläinen's great book, Lakota America, which is stunning.
Yeah.
I guess let me ask the question behind my question. What does Custer think he's going to be doing 20 years after the Little Bighorn?
Wow, that's a really good question. And I think he was trying at the time to prepare the way outside of the army, which he talked about, even though he never managed to operate outside of the army. And as I said, you know, he spent 2 years in New York. He made friends through his notoriety from the West to build up a reputation. He was in on a silver mine, which actually had silver, but he didn't put any effort into developing it. Which he was trying to just float the stock, you know, and sell out on the stock market. He was engaged in trading with a friendly trader who, because of his fame, allowed him to trade, you know, without any margin, to just, you know, go completely on his own hook. And it, unfortunately, because he was addicted to gambling, his first trades were successful, and that gave him, you know, the taste that he didn't lose, and so he went. Ultimately, $9,000 into debt, but he thought he could, you know, with his silver mine, with his stock trading, with his book and lectures. He also had was negotiating for a contract to go on the lecture circuit, which was a very big deal then, and he thought he could clear his debts and build up a nest egg. I think he eventually thought either he gets a generalship or he's out.
He's going to be wealthy. He's going to be a celebrity. He's going to be a man about town in New York.
Yeah,
going to be in.
He wasn't a great writer, though. I mean, you know, you've talked about that in the book, that he wasn't. Whereas I think Theodore Roosevelt was writing things that were popular and exciting, Custer's writing was kind of less exciting, banal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like his description of the Ouachita is actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where he really gets into the action. Or his description of Wild Bill Hickok is actually pretty good. So there's pieces in there that are interesting reading and kind of fun to read, just in terms of, you know, how he tells the story. Again, anybody who's sees the Ouachita as pure massacre, I'm not trying to defend it, but in terms of just his storytelling, there were points where he could actually tell a story, but he was just such an antebellum writer. I mean, my joke in the book is that the very first sentence of My Life in the Plains feels like it must have started before the Civil War because it takes so long to get to the end. It's just one long, winding, sentence. So, yeah, he was very much an old-fashioned kind of cram-every-word-in writer. And but, again, what's interesting is that he wanted to be seen as a public intellectual. So the first two chapters of My Life in the Plains are actually a serious attempt to talk about the natural history and the peoples of the Great Plains. And, you know, he's really trying to mark himself as a real authority, and he's not content with just being an entertainer, even though he knows that's what'll sell the book when it becomes a book. So it's interesting. There are all kinds of angles that come out of reading his writing.
I look forward to that, all the angles with TR, and I think no better person to take on this project because it is a big one. And a single volume, I guess, on TR is a challenge. So
it is.
I do look forward to it, TJ, and I can't thank you enough for joining the show. And Craig, thanks. Thanks, you too.
I've enjoyed every second of it.
The last thing I'll say is that, you know, when I got into, my first two books were about people who I thought hadn't been well covered before. But my last two with Custer and also especially with TR, there are a lot of real authorities, and I'm not imagining I'm going to, you know, tell everybody how it is. You know, it's my attempt to, as I put it in TR, maybe change the camera angle, you know, highlight certain things, emphasize other things without saying that the other approaches are in any way inadequate. So it's fun, but I'm trying to relieve the pressure on myself.
Well, that's all we can do as well. And so I think, thanks for the modesty, but I'm expecting great things anyway.
Thanks.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.